The Athletic.
Let's talk about six, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about six.
Salah down the line, the ball by Alexander-Arnold. Salah, oh, what a finish!
Robertson.
It'll flick on by Firmino.
Henderson. Tsimikas. Money!
Okay, so it's a mailbag special on today's pod. Ahead of a manic April, there's some burning questions on your minds. Contracts, succession planning, which trophies should take priority, and more. I'm Steve Hothersall. James Pearce is back from a hard-earned break to field the questions for you. So many questions. And a lot of people asking you about your break, James. Have you had a nice time? Did you feel like you needed a break the same time as the international football?
It was very nice, thanks, Steve. Yeah, thought I'd take the chance because I don't think there'll be many days off between now and the end of May. Looking at Liverpool's schedule, so I think like most supporters, you're looking at April especially and think, oh my God, has there ever been a month quite like it to be a Liverpool supporter with so many big games and so much up for grabs? So it was nice. Went to Malaga over there Monday to Friday, and then down in Dorset for a couple of days for my dad's 70th big family get together. Long drive back up to Liverpool yesterday, and then back into the swing of things. Looking forward to what's ahead.
He's got a footballer's lifestyle, hasn't he, James? Let's get into some serious business. We'll start with Aditya's question. Can you give your opinion on what should be the barrier for FSG to offer Salah in terms of salary? Now, of course, we fielded quite a few Salah things on previous podcasts, so we might go over some old ground. But Aditya also says, what should Salah demand to stay at Liverpool, and how can this settlement be reached?
Oh, I mean, it's a great question and a very difficult one to answer, isn't it? And I think the reason why this has dragged on so long is because it is so easy to see it from both sides, because I've never agreed with this. You know, I still see it on social media frequently, this just pay him whatever he wants. You can't run a business like that, and you certainly can't run a football club like it, because, you know, you give Salah exactly what he wants and you can guarantee there'll be a list of agents and players waiting outside Michael Edwards and Julian Ward's offices at Kirby wanting to renegotiate themselves. So I think it's a delicate balancing act. I mean, I think it goes without saying that you have to be offering, I'd certainly be offering him 300 grand a week. When you look at, you know, some of the figures banded around in the Premier League, I think that would probably be as high as I would personally go if I was in Liverpool's position, because I think that's stretching your wage structure without, you know, not going to ridiculous levels. And I think that also puts him in that higher echelon, not out on his own by any stretch of the imagination. When you look at, you know, De Bruyne, I think is over 350, 360 grand a week. I think Grealish is on 300. You know, you look at some of the figures banded around at United for De Gea, and see Pogba's still on the wage bill at the minute. But I think it has to be around that 300 grand a week mark. I think if Liverpool were to go as high as that and that still wasn't enough, then for me, that would be kind of like a bit of a line in the sand in terms of, do we really want to go beyond that? Because you know what the knock-on effect of that is. But it is very difficult, because I can see, you know, if you're Mo Salah and you look at his numbers, you know, you look at how durable he is, how much, you know, rarely ever misses a game, you know, and there's no sign of his, you know, his output slowing down. I can completely understand why he thinks, well, hang on a minute, why should those players elsewhere be earning so much more than I earn? So, and with the age he's at, he knows this is his last, well, it'd be his biggest contract and his kind of, you know, the last one he'll be able to really, you know, push as far as he possibly can. So, yeah, that's what makes it so complex. That's why I just think it's far too simplistic to say just give him what he wants, or the other way to kind of say, well, you know, he's being greedy. He's not being greedy. I think he just wants what he feels like he's worth. And we've talked about this so many times on the podcast during the season, and I've always felt that if it was still rumbling on into June, then I'd be very worried in terms of, you know, I think that's when you start to think it's not going to happen. For me at the minute, you know, I'm still optimistic when you look at not only how good Salah's been for Liverpool, but how good Liverpool as a club has been for Salah in terms of bringing out the best in him and taking him to the next level? Would he, even though of course there'll be clubs wanting to take him off Liverpool's hands, would he really fit the style as good as he does at Liverpool? Would he be adored by the fans? Would he have a manager that makes him tick quite like Klopp does? These next 2 months are huge, I think, in terms of whether of how that gets resolved.
I mean, there's arguments on both sides, and there's fans in both camps as well. And you referred there to a deadline. So Steve Murphy is asking this question. When do you think is a realistic deadline for Salah to have signed his contract? But I think if you stand back and look at the end of this season, James, there's probably not an appropriate time to be dealing with that now, is there?
No. I thought it was telling the other week when Klopp actually kind of said, you know, he was kicking himself for saying what he felt was too much on Salah's contract situation, because then we had the situation where, you know, when you actually boil it down, he didn't really say that much. But of course, because there's so much interest from, you know, I'd say the media and supporters, I think, you know, when I've written about Salah's future recently, I've had people say to me, oh, you know, it's a media obsession, you know, it's not really an issue or whatever. And it's like, well, hang on a minute. I don't have that, because, you know, I get stopped, you know, regularly, whether it's in the aisle at Tesco's or at the petrol station. And, you know, is Salah staying? Is he going? You know, of course people care, because he deserves to be mentioned up there with the, you know, the greatest legends who have ever played for Liverpool when you look at what he's achieved in recent seasons. So, of course, people, you know, are concerned about what might happen. But yeah, obviously Klopp felt, well, hang on a minute. What he said, you know, inadvertently made headlines. And then, of course, the agent then replied to that. And so I think Klopp was just saying, you know, I said too much, because he won't want any distractions. You know, Liverpool are in a position at the minute they've never been in the club's entire history, you know, going into April, still being in contention to pull off a clean sweep. So the last thing that Klopp will want is, you know, any sideshows, any distractions. So no, I think it will be, you know, of course, what a boost that would give everyone if it can be resolved in the next month or so. But yeah, if not, then, you know, the back end of the season into the summer. I think probably the start of pre-season is a kind of a realistic point where you go, well, we kind of need to know now, because of course, you know, the elephant in the room is, if it's still dragging on into July, what do you do as a club? Do you ultimately accept in July that you're probably going to lose him for nothing in 2023? Or do you think, well, we can't possibly let someone who's so valuable leave for nothing, so we'd have to, you know, reluctantly consider offers for him if he won't sign a contract which is the most we're willing to offer? So, but, you know, I think you have to caveat that with recent history shows that, you know, certainly there won't be a scenario where Liverpool would just sell him, you know, just to get something for him. Because I think if you look back to Emre Can, you look back to Gini Wijnaldum, in the end, they decided, well, actually, you know, we're better off keeping that player for the last year rather than cashing in. I think they would have considered selling Wijnaldum when he had a year left if they'd have got a decent offer. You know, essentially, Thiago was Wijnaldum's replacement, and they ended up signing his replacement a year early because they were braced for a bid from Barcelona that never arrived. And then it was like, well, we're not just going to get rid of him for 10 or 15 million. So we're better off keeping him. And it was, like I said before that, a few years before that, it was the same with Emre Can. So again, you know, you look at it, you know, how much would Mo Salah be worth when he gets down to his last year this summer? I still think you're talking about, I mean, he's a £100 million footballer. When, you know, you look at what Real Madrid were prepared to throw at PSG to get Mbappe out when he was down to his last year last summer, you know, and Salah's numbers stack up in comparison. I know he's obviously older. That's why I think it is so complex with no easy answers. And, you know, with the baton being passed over from Michael Edwards to Julian Ward pretty soon, you know, undoubtedly that is the biggest thing that he's got to wrestle with. And it's, you know, it's not just Salah. Obviously, Mane and Firmino are in exactly the same boat. And then you've got, you know, a situation where Oxlade-Chamberlain and Naby Keita come down to Lair last year as well. And, you know, that they're probably in a different bracket in terms of, do you really want to commit to giving them another long-term contract? Or again, you know, do you cash in or run the risk of losing them for nothing 12 months down the line? So there's a lot of big decisions ahead.
They've got all these riches going forward. Scouser TI says, have Liverpool opened contract talks with Mane and Firmino? I can't be the only fan who's a bit concerned that there hasn't been any reporting on their future. Well, there has been reporting on their future, but I suppose it's a case of Salah's story overshadows two other brilliant players. I mean, if Salah wasn't there, Mane would be an absolutely ginormous story here, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think you've got to remember as well, it kind of works both ways in terms of, you know, when I spoke to, you know, I did a piece on Salah, Mane and Firmino, I think a big read on The Athletic towards the end of December, early January. You know, and when I spoke to people close to Mane and Firmino, they were both seemed very relaxed about the situation. Certainly, you know, the feedback from Mane's camp was that, you know, there wasn't really anything happening regarding an extension at that time, but there was no hint of concern. Because I think, you know, also, you know, for players, it almost, you know, once they get down to close to their last year, it increases their, you know, negotiating power when it comes to, you know, other suitors coming in for them, thinking, well, hang on a minute, he's only got a year left. You know, if you're talking about a lower fee, then you're talking about bigger signing on fees and bigger salaries. So it's not just a one-way thing when a player's contract starts to run down. And I think it has been a modern trend as well. I think back 5 or 10 years, and it always used to be, you know, if a player gets to his last 2 years, you know, if you want to keep a player, you have to then extend it. You know, you don't want to risk it going inside the last 2 years. But I don't think that really applies anymore. We've seen, you know, people moving on frees becoming a lot more common, clubs waiting until a player is down to his last year before making a definitive decision on them. And I think the other thing you'd have to say is that clearly Salah's future, sorting that out, has been the priority. And I think what happens with him is bound to have a knock-on effect on what happens with Mane and Firmino, because the difference is so big, isn't it, between Salah putting pen to paper on a new 3 or 4 year deal or the prospect of him moving on. And then, you know, that bound to have an impact on then how you view Mane and Firmino. And I mean, certainly out of the three of them, I've always thought that if one was going to stay and go as a free agent, it always made more sense to me that one would be Firmino out of the three. Just because I think when you look at it from the outside, he's probably the one with the lowest resale value. You know, I think Firmino's that type of player that, you know, he's adored by Liverpool fans, and he's got such a unique skill set. And he proved at Arsenal the other week that he's still got a lot to offer. But he's not a guaranteed starter anymore. Since Jota has come in, he's effectively become a squad option. So, you know, I think that makes sense to me, that if you're going to allow one of them to run the contract down, then it would be Firmino, on the basis that I don't see there being a big market out there for clubs to come in and pay big transfer fees for him. But yeah, it's all interlinked, isn't it? And I think that's why there has been such a focus on Salah, because not only is he the main man, but what happens with him is bound to have a bit of a knock-on and an impact on what happens for others.
We've talked about the attack. Kevin Wrigley says we can see that succession planning. We can see it for the defence as well. But what is happening with the midfield with Milner, Henderson, and after that, Fabinho? Where does the succession planning lie?
Well, again, I think in terms of the midfield, you can see it starting to evolve already, can't you? With, you know, Harvey Elliott, his role is only going to grow. We've seen Klopp effectively turn him from a right-sided attacker into a central midfielder. Now, Elliot, still so young, come back from a serious injury. His involvement is only going to increase. You know, Curtis Jones, I think, you know, it's been a strange season for Curtis, really. You know, still, again, in footballing terms, still so young. It's been quite stop-start, I'd say. There's been some, like, flashes of absolute brilliance. Then he's found himself kind of not even making the bench at times and, you know, lit up games on occasion, then hasn't been able to kick on and really establish himself in the team. So I'd say it's a big couple of months ahead for him. Yeah, of course, you know, at the minute Milner is out of contract in the summer, you know, I know Klopp has kind of spoken about, you know, he would like to keep him on board. We know that Milner is obviously considering his options because, you know, at the age he's at, it's bound to be a heavily incentivized contract based on appearances. And he may well be looking at it and thinking, well, am I really going to feature that much next season? Would it be a season when he's turning 37? You know, Henderson's still got a few years left in him, hasn't he? Undoubtedly. Fabinho is younger and, you know, will be a, you know, an absolute mainstay of that midfield for for years to come, thankfully. But yeah, obviously Thiago is now the other side of 30, isn't he? And then we spoke before, didn't we, about Keita and Oxlade-Chamberlain. That's an intriguing thing for me, because what do you do there in terms of, do you give those, you know, new contracts this summer? And if not, are you going to move them on, or are you going to just accept that they'll probably leave for nothing 12 months down the line? So yeah, certainly midfield is an area where I see Liverpool reinforcing this summer, because, you know, I think the likelihood is that at least one of the current midfielders will leave, if not two.
Question marks against a few of them at the moment. Look, we're talking succession planning. Let's finish this topic with one from Rachel, regular listener, who says, lots of people already worried about Klopp. I'm sure you get asked as much about Klopp as you do as Salah. Clearly that contract situation with him saying that maybe in a couple of years, that's the end of the managerial job for him, and maybe some time out. But anything further on the succession planning there? Again, we've talked about it on the pod before. It seems like Pep Linders would be the obvious choice. She's mentioned Gerrard there. You know, I think Gerrard will probably admit it's maybe too soon for him already. Is Pep Linders still the obvious conversation that goes around this?
I think he's probably under-talked about in kind of wider circles when it comes to the conversation around who takes over from Klopp, because I think probably, you know, I think a lot of Liverpool fans probably know just how regarded Pep Linders is, but I'm not sure if people do across football in general. I think, you know, if Pep Linders was to be appointed as Klopp's successor, I think in the wider footballing community there would be, oh, you know, that's a massive gamble for someone who's only, you know, managed at senior level in Holland for a couple of months. But I think that overlooks the immense respect that Pep Linders commands in the dressing room, with the owners, with the other staff, and how knowledgeable he is as a coach. So I think we talked about it earlier on in the season, and we probably around the time that Steven Gerrard was coming back to Anfield with Villa, the fact that, you know, Pep Linders for me is still the biggest, you know, kind of contender alongside Gerrard to be Klopp's successor. And I think, you know, it's still over 2 years away, isn't it? There is not a definitive plan in place for who takes over from Klopp, because for a start, you know, the ideal scenario for FSG is that Jurgen Klopp wakes up one morning and rings Mike Gordon and says, you know, I'll stay around till 2026. And that would be probably the quickest contract drawn up in the history of football, I think, if Klopp indicated he was willing to give it another couple of years. But certainly as we sit here now, there's not been any indication up to this point that Klopp will have a rethink. I just think also in football, so much can change, can't it, in a couple of years in terms of, you know, the rise and fall of certain coaches, and, you know, whose stock is so high 1 minute can be not even in contention the next. So, yeah, and I still think, you know, people will question, you know, as you said before, Steve, like, you know, would Gerrard have enough experience come that time? And I think, well, let's wait and see what he does with Aston Villa in the next 2 years, because a lot can happen in that point. And if he's got Aston Villa playing in Europe in 2 years' time, and, you know, they're a top probably eight Premier League team, then you'd have to say, you know, what more would you expect him to do at Aston Villa to prove that he was ready to take the next step? And, you know, there's always question marks against everyone, isn't there? I think Klopp was almost unique in that the only managerial appointment I can ever remember where there was not one dissenting voice that I could remember. I remember being outside the Hope Street Hotel in town when he arrived on that, you know, October afternoon in 2015, and it was like you were looking around thinking, how on earth does this guy ever live up to expectations when, you know, everyone is absolutely convinced he's the Messiah and is going to transform things? And the biggest compliment you could pay Klopp is that he hasn't just lived up to that, he's exceeded it with the job he's done. And I guess in the same way as the Ferguson factor at Old Trafford, you could make a claim for saying, well, you'd almost be better to be the man after the next man rather than the man taking over from Klopp, because it's going to be such an incredibly hard act to follow. The flip side of that is that FSG would say that despite Klopp being this huge personality and this who just impacts across the whole club, that they'd like to think that they've got a structure in place that, you know, it could withstand the exit of a key man like him, in the same way as, you know, they think that they can kick on without Michael Edwards, on the basis that, you know, obviously Julian Ward has been kind of groomed as his successor. You think, well, you know, maybe they'll go down a similar path with Pep Linders, because going for Linders would ensure that, you know, there would be a lot of continuity. And we've seen before that, you know, continuity is something the owners like.
Yeah, you've written on that. People can check that out on an article you've done recently. Let's move to the FA Cup semi-finals. Joe says, I'm absolutely disgusted with the FA. I'm sure you are, James, as well. Jordan Henderson has spoken out. Will they never learn? I think we know the answer to that is no.
Yeah, I think, do you know what? You know, seeing that unfold, you know, last week, and I just, you know, I remember like reading it when I was away and thinking, there's 0.0 chance that the FA or change it from Wembley. It was never going to happen, was it? You know, money talks. You know, we see it with the timing of kickoffs. Fans are just an absolute afterthought. And I think that the sad thing for me is I kind of hope that the pandemic might lead to a bit of a reset where people in authority would look at it and go, oh my God, actually, you know, football without those supporters is a pretty soulless, you know, crap spectacle. That actually, God, that they make it, the fans, that, and that maybe we should stop taking them for granted and just, you know, oh, they'll find a way. They, you know, they always find a way to get there. That's always it, isn't it? It's like when UEFA play major finals in places that are virtually impossible to get to and don't have hotel rooms, and it's like, oh, you know, they'll be all right. You know, there'll be enough people desperate to go that the seats will still get filled. And it's just wrong, isn't it? And it's a similar story with this FA Cup semi. The fact that you can't get a train down there and you've got two Northwest clubs, and especially with it being the semi-final as well, where you get a lot more tickets than you get for the final.
But it's never made any sense having the game there anyway, James, has it? I mean, I think if you ask most fans, they're not bothered about going to Wembley for a semi-final. No. I cast my mind back to 2006 and think Old Trafford and Garcia's goal and incredible atmosphere. Aston Villa. Yeah, yeah. These are great venues for semis.
Yeah, but again, it comes down to money, doesn't it? Because they're great venues for semis, but they're not venues as big as Wembley, and they're not venues owned by the FA. And I think once they spent that eye-watering sum of money on Wembley, that, you know, what was it? So over budget and so behind the schedule, that you just knew that they were gonna, you know, milk it for as much as it was possibly worth to try and pay the bills. And that's effectively where we're at. I mean, there has to, you know, it's, you know, it makes me angry thinking about it, but it's almost like I didn't expect anything different.
No.
And that's a pretty sad position to be in, isn't it? Where it's like, you know, it was like, well, of course they should move it. Everything tells you they should move it. Why on earth would you want, you know, the best part of 90,000 people coming down from the Northwest to London, you know, clogging up all the roads because, you know, you can't even get a train down yet? You just knew that it wasn't going to happen. In the same way as you get lunchtime kickoffs, you know, at 12, Liverpool playing Southampton away at 12:30 on the South Coast. And it's just so wrong, but it's just not even a factor, is it? It's about money and it's about TV contracts, and fans are just an absolute afterthought.
On the money front, there's quite a few questions here. Sean, Alex, talking about FSG, and I don't know how intensely you focused on this yourself. I'm just throwing this at you. So, James, interested what FSG think about the proposed changes, to FFP. Sean says, how do clubs circumnavigate FFP? Whether the proposed new 70% cap will make a difference. I think we'll have to ask Simon Hughes this on the next mailbag. He's probably
all I would say on that is that, you know, it's definitely been a huge frustration for the FSG hierarchy, for, you know, for John W. Henry, Tom Werner and Mike Gordon, the fact that, you know, when they bought Liverpool, you know, FFP was a big part of the kind of decision behind it, was because they were like, well, hang on a minute, you know, look at the huge potential of this club, and we're coming into a sport where they're bringing in these rules of FFP that, you know, you have to live within your means. And so essentially, you know, the more money you generate, you know, the more money you can spend, but you can't just have a bottomless pit of cash that you just throw at it. And then I think it was a massive disappointment to them that those rules have never really been properly enforced. And I think they've been proven to not be worth the paper they're written on. So, you know, I think anything that comes in that levels that playing field in terms of ensuring that clubs do have to live within their means, then that has to be good news for Liverpool and be welcomed by FSG, because I think what we do know is they aren't going to change tact. You know, people, you know, whenever the transfer window comes around, isn't it, it's like, you know, are they gonna Are they going to, you know, is the time right? For, you know, are they going to finally, you know, put $100 million in or whatever? And it's just not. It's never been their way. They were transparent from the start that it was. This is a club that has to live within its means. It's self-sustaining, which makes what Klopp and everyone at Liverpool has achieved during his tenure all the more remarkable. When you look, you know, what does the net spend? Something like $200 million less than Man City in the last 5 or 6 years. Yet, you know, there they are going toe to toe with them. So I think, yeah, anything that makes it, you know, more difficult for clubs to just throw unlimited pots of cash at it, especially when you look at the situation with Newcastle, you know, with their spending power now, I'm sure FSG will have one eye on that in terms of, well, you know, what does that mean for the future? So yeah, I think certainly the rules need to change, because the ones that we've had, you know, haven't been fit for purpose.
Let's finish this mailbag looking ahead to a massive April and end of the season. And Halps straight away in with this one. If you could pick any two trophies to win out of the three left, which ones would it be? I think that's an obvious one, isn't it? maybe pick one trophy out of the three left. Oh. Got to be the Premier League, hasn't it? Just because the fans never celebrated it.
Yeah. I think there's something so special, isn't there, about Liverpool and the European Cup. That's the only thing. And you think about Paris in late May would be an incredible place to be. But yeah, I think you're right, Steve. I think because winning the Premier League after that 30-year wait wasn't what anyone thought it would be. You know, as good as Liverpool were for so much of that season, the fact that the champagne was on ice for a long time because of the pandemic, and then they were denied the trappings that should have come with it, weren't they? With, you know, no parade. You know, what was one of the lucky few hundred inside Anfield on the night that Jordan Henderson lifted the trophy, but you couldn't help but gaze around with a degree of sadness, thinking, you know, it really shouldn't have been like this. You know, imagine what this place would have been like with 54,000 people in here for this moment. And, you know, even things like, you know, the first day of the following season, and, you know, Liverpool walking out as Premier League champions, and just that buzz that would have been around the place, and, you know, denied that because I think it was Leeds, wasn't it? You know, behind the closed doors. And so, yeah, I think it would have to be the Premier League for me out of the three remaining. I mean, there's a good reason why no one's ever done the clean sweep before, because it's incredibly difficult. You only have to look at April's fixture list and then, you know, what May would be like as well if they did go through April still with everything still possible. But, you know, what you'd have to say is, you know, the depth of this squad has come to the fore time after time, and it's such a delicate balancing act for Klopp, you know, with the rotation, because, you know, on the one hand, you're trying to keep things fresh, you're trying to make sure that fatigue doesn't play a part, yet you know if you make too many changes, it becomes disjointed, and, you know, which is probably what happened at Forest the other week. You know, that was by, you know, miles away from the levels Liverpool can play at, yet, you know, they have got this remarkable resilience where they can grind it out when not at their best. And I think that's going to be absolutely crucial through April as well, because it's not realistic to think that they're just going to play with a swagger throughout these eight games in, you know, what is it, 24, 25 days or whatever crazy setup it is. So, but yeah, I think more than anything, it's just exciting, isn't it? The fact that, you know, how many seasons have you had where, you know, you get to this point and you're, you know, the limit of your expectations is, you know, can they sneak into the top four? Yet, you know, we're talking about a team that's already won one trophy and could end up with the lot.
The problem with these expectations is when we talk about a quadruple, we start to convince ourselves that they'll win multiple trophies. They've only won one so far. There's no guarantee that they win another. You can't have a bus parade for just a League Cup trophy, can you? So we're still pretty much, it's a nervous month, isn't it, April?
Yeah, definitely. Because that's it. There's the difference between what could happen this season, you know, like when you look at it, you know, best case scenario, worst case scenario. And I think you're right. You're in a situation where Liverpool could still have a pretty impressive end to the season, yet not win another trophy. Because, you know, for a start, you could easily play well and lose to Manchester City in an FA Cup semi-final. That's just the reality, because City are that good a team. You could easily win most of your remaining Premier League games and not win the league, because, you know, you're talking about potentially having to go to the Etihad and win, which is incredibly difficult. And then you've got the Champions League, where if everything goes to form, I think it'll be a Liverpool-Man City final in Paris, which, is mouthwatering. But again, you could play well in the Champions League final in Paris against them and still not come out on top. And yeah, I think it's exciting and nerve-wracking and all in equal measure, isn't it, in terms of what's going to be in store. But I'd still rather have this than than scrapping for a top four place, because it's what you want, isn't it? You want games that mean everything. And that's why I think, you know, there's never been a month quite like April as we go into it now, where, you know, a potential title decider against Man City, an FA Cup semi against them, you know, two legs of a Champions League quarterfinal, Man United, Everton thrown in there as well. So yeah, you've just, you know, Klopp always talks about it, doesn't he? He always tells the players, you know, this isn't pressure, this is opportunity. And, you know, I'm sure he'll be coming out with that saying many times at Kirby over the next few weeks, because, you know, certainly up to this point, Liverpool haven't looked like a team playing under pressure. And I think it does help the fact that the vast majority of these players have been there before. It's not uncharted territory. They've been there and won the biggest prizes. They know what it takes, and they've shown that they can win games in different ways. So yeah, I'd be very, very surprised if they didn't have something else as well as the Carabao Cup for that open top bus tour.
James, thank you very much indeed for fielding all those questions in the mailbag. Don't forget, if you're not already a subscriber to The Athletic, you can read all the articles on Liverpool and everything else on the site if you head to theathletic.com/Liverpool pod. Special price right now, £1 a month for 6 months. So that's theathletic.com/Liverpool pod. Thanks for listening to The Red Agenda. We'll catch you next time.